If you're struggling to lose weight, you've probably heard about weight loss medications like Wegovy or Zepbound, and you might be wondering if they're right for you. Meet PlushCare, a leading telehealth provider with doctors who are there for you day and night to partner with you in your weight loss journey. If you qualify, they can safely prescribe you medication from the comfort of your own home. To get started, visit plushcare.com/weightloss. That's plushcare.com/weightloss. plushcare.com/weightloss.
Mom deserves the best, and there's no better place to shop for Mother's Day than Whole Foods Market. They're your destination for unbeatable savings, from premium gifts to show-stopping flowers and irresistible desserts. Start by saving 33% with Prime on all body care and candles. Then get a 15-stem bunch of tulips for just $9.99 each with Prime. Round out Mom's menu with festive rosé, irresistible berry chantilly cake, and more special treats. Come celebrate Mother's Day at Whole Foods Market.
Hey, it's Paige DeSorbo from Giggly Squad. High quality fashion without the price tag. Say hello to Quince. I'm snagging high end essentials like cozy cashmere sweaters, sleek leather jackets, fine jewelry, and so much more. With Quince being 50 to 80% less than similar brands. And they partner with factories that prioritize safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. I love that. Luxury quality within reach. Go to quince.com/style to get free shipping and 365-day returns on your next order. quince.com/style.
This episode is brought to you by Paramount Plus. Get in, loser! Mean Girls is now streaming on Paramount Plus. Join Katie Heron as she meets the plastics and Tina Fey's new twist on the modern classic. Get ready for more of the rumors, backstabbing, and jokes you loved from the original movie with some fetch surprises. Rated PG-13. Wear pink and head to ParamountPlus.com to try it free.
What's going on, everybody? Hope you are having a great week so far. So coming up on today's episode is the one and only Got Some. I've known Adam for a long time, probably 4 or 5 years, maybe a bit longer actually. Bristol boy, born and bred, has great knowledge in music, one of the best, and is like a huge part of the Bristol scene. Has a few records, or he had a massive record called Baseline back in the day, now coming back with some big ones on Defected's imprint, D for Dance, on Tool Room. Really nice, like, vocally driven records. Go check them out. But before, don't forget to hit subscribe and leave some comments in the comment section. It keeps the podcast going. And let's do it without further ado. Got Some. And we're live. What's cooking, man?
We're here, live in the studio.
Live and direct. Let me turn
you live on. And direct. I might try and get some more light on us later on.
I think the lighting's good, man.
Oh, yeah, it was better before, wasn't it?
Yeah.
Okay.
It's like a bloody photo shoot over there.
I just wanted everyone to
there.
See the SSR, really.
Is it an SSR?
Yeah. It's only a small one. It's a little Matrix one. Mm. And you know what? I haven't learned how to use it. It's a guy that I share with. So
yeah.
I'm learning how to use it soon, so... You're going to hear better mixes. Well, just, let's see.
Just be able to run everything through, innit?
That's the vibe, yeah.
How's life? Well, I saw you last week, I know, but...
Yeah. It's good. It's just trying to focus on writing lots of new music.
Yeah.
And that is key right now, is... Because we just don't know when we're really going to be DJing. Mm. Like, it's so uncertain, the whole DJing thing. So it's like... Just got to focus on one thing that we actually know what we're doing, and that is writing music.
Yeah, I agree, man. I agree. It's a shit time, but also I was talking to Charlene Hector this morning.
Yeah.
And
I'm actually doing the tune with her.
Oh, cool. She's dope, man. She's amazing. Yeah. She sang Hallelujah.
Yeah. I didn't know that.
Yeah, she re-sang that. But yeah, like, we were just talking, like, about kind of not touring and everything like that, and how I don't know about you, but do you feel like super busy but there's no shows? Like, I'm like non-stop all the time. Like, my days are just slammed, and I'm like, I don't know how I'm gonna go back to it, like, touring on top of doing everything I'm doing.
Yeah, it's funny, I did a couple of live streams like last week or the week before, and I did two in one day, And I was like having, I had a bit of food in between and I was like, wow, this feels like doing gigs, like two gigs a night.
Yeah.
And I was like, I haven't done that for like a year or so. It's just weird. It's such a weird feeling. So yeah, I think we're all going to be really knackered when we start DJing again.
Yeah, man. Late nights and early mornings, no sleep. It's going to be great.
Yeah. Yeah. Trust me.
I can't wait. I cannot wait. It's going to be I think the thing is we're getting closer and closer to it happening.
Yeah.
But we just know that it could just be taken away from us.
Yeah, I'm a bit of a pessimist when it comes to this. I've been really positive and I've always wanted it, but I don't want to have my hopes cut.
Yeah.
So what I do is I kind of, when it comes to this, I kind of hope for the worst. No, like think about the worst and then the best will come. Do you know what I mean?
No, I totally agree. You set no expectations, do you?
Yeah, no expectations. But you know what? Like more than DJing, I just want to be in a field with my mates dancing to music or like in a club with like couple of my mates. That's all I worry about. Like for me, like DJing is like, you know, it's a bonus, do you know what I mean? But to have that feeling of being in a club with your mates listening to tunes that you like love hearing.
Yeah. That's like, I think it's that socializing thing that none of us have been able to really do for a long time, isn't it? It's just people wanna see people.
Like that was the reason why I got into it is because I was a raver. Do you know what I mean? I was like, all I wanted to do was go to clubs and listen to music. That was all from a young age. That was my main thing that I wanted to do in my life.
What was it like growing up in Bristol back in the day then?
It was cool because I was brought up in the 90s in Bristol and it was like, you know, we were so lucky, but we didn't even know that we were lucky.
It's always the way. You know? Always the way, right?
It was like, I used to skateboard, I used to listen to hip hop, and then like jungle music. And that was life, you know? And I used to go skateboarding around Bristol. And every Sunday, there used to be like 10 or 20 of us that used to go skating. And at the time, they were like quite big skateboarders, like Danny Wainwright. There was about five pro skaters that used to run 50-50 in that. And we just used to go skateboarding and just used to go mad, like go ham through town and go the multi-story car parks and like start at the top and like go down. And that was like the vibe. And then I started hanging out with DJ Dai.
I've never met him.
Yeah. He was kind of like a teacher for me at the time and just like, I wasn't a DJ. I wasn't a producer. I literally liked hip hop and was getting into jungle music. And obviously at that point, he was fully into jungle music. He had come from hardcore. Obviously he had a crew with Jody Waskinoff. And they had a crew together called Sub Love. And that was like in the hardcore rave days. And I used to hang out with Dai and he's like, after going skating on Sundays, he'd be like, yeah, come to the studio or whatever. And I used to come to the studio and like smoke weed with him and stuff and just hang out. And then like loads of people would come past the studio, like Smith and Mighty, Crust, and like Crust brother, a guy called Flynn, who again was a big person in the Bristol music scene. And they all used to come past. And again, I was quite unaware of who they were at the time. And they were just playing us songs. And it was like mad hearing the hip hop culture and the early jungle culture. And obviously the rave culture. It was all being amalgamated at that time.
Mm.
So it was like Smith and Mike did that watching Walk On By, you know, and they sampled like a funky drummer or something.
Yeah,
and it was at the same time that like Nelly Hooper was around, and Nelly Hooper did obviously Massive Attack, and later on did Bjork and Janet Jackson and Madonna and people like that, you know. So there was a big amalgamation of like these Bristol hip hop heads being in Bristol in the mid 90s, and jungle appearing.
Yeah,
and there was like there was hip-hop jungle being made, and there was jungle being made. And then there was obviously jungle hardcore as well. And it was all like, it was mad, like, seeing it all happening, unfolding in front of me, but also being oblivious of it as well. But obviously, that being around that from such a young age influenced me a great deal.
Well, so did you start writing jungle?
No, originally I literally started DJing. I got a job at a supermarket in my local area, and the guy that I was doing nights with in the supermarket was a hip hop DJ, and he kept bringing me tapes, like hip hop tapes with like Nas and Biggie and BDP, and just like proper sick. And he used to do beat juggling and scratching and stuff. And I was like, wow, this is mad. And then at the same time, I was hanging out with Dai, and he was like teaching me how to do doubles and stuff. And also one of my best friends from school bought a pair of Technics as well. And I was like, after that summer of hanging out with them all, I was like, yo, I need to buy some turntables.
Yeah.
And it was like, I'm going to do anything to get them turntables. So then I bought the turntables, and then it was just that standard, like, buying, saving money up to buy jungle. Really, yeah, jungle and hip-hop. And just buying religiously every week, trying to buy, like, 4 records or 5 records.
There used to be some great record shops in Bristol as well.
Yeah, so there was, like, Replay Records, which was originally by the bus station. And then there was a place called Purple Penguin, which is pretty cool. There's a guy called Jamie and a few guys that were, like, stand-up dudes. And, yeah, and then there was a place called Eat the Beat as well. And we just used to basically run around the shops trying to, like, blag white labels. And then there was another place where Jake's used to work, and it was on where Kushti is now.
Okay.
It's called Breakbeat. What was it called? Breakbeat.
Is Kushti still open? Kushti.
Yeah, Kushti's still open. Yeah. 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 Big up. If you're in Bristol, go to Kushti, definitely.
That's great.
But yeah, so I just used to go to the record shops, and it was just like, obviously, when you're into jungle, the whole promo and white label, dub plate culture, it was all about having the record before your mate had the record. Yeah. And it was like, yeah, I got the white label of it. And it's like, yeah, I'm going to go, even if you're playing in your bedroom, it was like, yeah, I got the white label. So it was like, that was the thing. And
well, in-house, the white labels were more just like remixes. Bootlegs and remixes that they weren't allowed to technically press, but they just like pressed like 200 copies, and
yeah,
it was like gold dust getting them.
Yeah, still really exclusive, but I think with the jungle, it was just like with dub plate culture. It's funny because with dub plate culture, a producer will write a song, and then they'll get it put on record, like on acetate. And it'll be on like a 10-inch acetate.
Yeah.
And it'll be on that. It could be on that for like 2 years before it gets signed.
Yeah.
And the whole thing is what they did with dub plate culture is you'd write a song on Monday, Tuesday, Wednesday. You'd go to like Music House or Metropolis on Thursday and Friday. And then you'd go to Fabric on Friday to play that record. Mm. And everyone would be standing around waiting for that DJ to play a record that they never heard before.
Yeah.
And that was like the whole thing with dub plate culture.
Well, I think that was a lot to do with music culture back then, even in house, like early 90s, early 2000s, no, late 90s, early 2000s is like when I can remember. And you'd have like in Ibiza, you'd have one record for the summer that was the track of the summer.
Yeah, yeah, sure.
You just don't get that now.
No, because it's the music industry has gone, it's so mechanical now.
Yeah.
And the fact that, there's no longevity with a song, or not that I can see it as much longevity. It's more like it comes out, it will go into Beatport, it will go into playlists in Spotify, and then it's got a cycle.
Mm.
When before, it was all about prolonging that cycle. So it's like, if your song was on dubplate, it would be more wanted. People would want it more. It'd be like, oh my God, that song, I can't get... It's like, it's funny. When I did the Kanye West edit, a fade that I did, I kind of had that idea in that I wanted to write it, but it was just for me.
Yeah.
It was like an edit that I wanted to do. I think I was playing at Boomtown or something on one of them really big stages. And I was like, oh, I really just want to write a song that I could play on that stage to finish.
Yeah.
And I looked and I listened to it and I was like, listen to all of the samples from it. And I was like, this is a house record.
Yeah, yeah.
Obviously, Kanye and Hudmo and Benji made it into a hip-hop record. And I was just like, the way that they put it together was amazing. And I just kind of wanted to respect it in a way, but I wanted to play it in my sets.
Yeah.
And so I made it. And then everyone and their dog wanted it. And I was like, it's not really mine to give out even, you know, because it's... Originally, it's Larry Heard. Do you know what I mean? It's Mr. Fingers.
Yeah, yeah.
And then obviously Hudson Mohawk and them guys did it for Kanye. And it's like, I couldn't, everyone, every 5 minutes, it's like people hitting me up with like Diplo and Afrojack and Groove Armada, like literally everyone. And I was just like, obviously I'll give it to you guys to play, but that wasn't the concept. But the whole idea of that keeping it exclusive, it's kind of gone now, you know?
It's
mystery.
It's something that has that when it, like it happened with me with Hallelujah. Like,
yeah,
I literally wrote that for myself.
Yeah.
And then a few people started asking for it and then it turned into what it is. And
yeah.
But for me, those records are the ones that still do the best.
Yeah.
That they grow a hype around. Like, classic example was the Rebuke Along Came Polly.
Yeah, exactly.
Like, exactly. Jamie was playing that in his sets for a year before that came out. Like,
yeah.
Ruben sent that to me, like, before it even got signed.
Yeah.
And it was just like, wow, this is going to be amazing.
Yeah.
But it would have... It only did that well because it was literally a handful of DJs playing it and that had their hands on it and that could get their hands on it. Because I know, like... I remember like Ruben telling me, he was like, dude, like, make sure that you don't get recorded playing this because Jamie will flip, if you know what I mean, because he wants it just for himself. And I think there's a part of that where it's like, we think in this day and age that we have to give our music to everyone.
Yeah.
And like DJ promo culture is that you just send it to everyone and hope that someone gets it. But all you need is like that one video.
Yeah,
and it just slams everywhere now, which is it's different to how it used to be, because I think what it is now it's more of a commercialized industry, right? So
it's a commercialized industry because anyone can get anything.
Yeah,
and that happens in everything within culture.
Mm-hmm.
So, like, the whole thing with rave culture is that you are lucky to be at that party.
Yeah.
You were lucky. Say if you went to a rave in the country and you got that invite or you got that call and you got on the motorway and you found out where it was. It was like you were lucky to be there.
Yeah.
And you were wearing the clothes that you were wearing there, you know. People saw that and they were like, oh, I like that style. Mm. But now, because of Instagram and Shazam, it's so easy for anyone to get it. So it's like... Say if I had a new pair of sneakers on and I went to a party, someone could just take that picture of that sneaker and find out what it is.
Straight away.
Back in the day, you went to a rave and you heard a song.
Mm.
The only way you're going to find out about that song is by like listening to it again and again on the tape pack. And then you would take the tape to the record shop and you would hum that bass line to that record guy and go boom 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 boom,
yeah,
or like, you know, something like that.
Or you'd hope somebody played it on radio, like on like Pete would play it on Radio One,
yeah,
or Pete, like,
or Fabio Groove Fabio, Rider, or yeah, Bay, yeah. Or, you know. And but it was like it made music style and culture so much more exclusive, and that you really had to want to be a part of it.
Yeah.
You really wanted to have to be in the scene. You had to go to the parties. You'd have to wear certain bomber jackets. You know, like, when you go to a rave, like back in the day with Universe and Fantasia, they all had their own bomber jackets.
Yeah.
And it was like you wanted to be a part of that, you know, because that's what you did. And now you maybe get like people wearing space T-shirts or Pasha T-shirts or Ushuaia T-shirts that never have gone to clubs, don't even listen to EDM or dance music, you know. So I guess it's changed a lot, you know.
Well, I think that's the joys of Facebook, right? It started at Facebook. Yeah. And I remember when I was like helping people promote in Bristol, and the first thing you do was add everybody in on Facebook that was that you didn't have a clue who was and in the city, and you just like push, like everyone could go to the party, where before it used to be like, okay, how do we get to a party first of all? Like these free parties, that you, like how do we get there? First of all, you like got to go to an address, then you get a telephone number, then you got to call the telephone number, then you like
that was a mission in its own.
Exactly.
Before you even got to
you had to do it. I did it in Detroit. I did a party at Red Rooms.
Yeah.
And we didn't announce the venue. Well, we didn't announce the venue at all. We were like, you have to text this number, and you'd get an automatic text of where it would go. And it just created a really interesting vibe. Like
it creates a buzz, and it also reaffirms that all of the people that are at the party want to be at the party.
Exactly.
They're not there because they want to look cool. They're not there just to catch girls. They're not there because they think they need to be there. They're there because they made the effort and they've really, really gone to town to get there.
Well, I think, you know, and that's the thing, is like when we kind of built the party out, we were like, I was like, okay, so it has to have a fucking great sound system. Like it has to have that and zero lights. I think we had like two like little flashing lights on the speakers, and then everything else is just pitch black. Yeah. And it just gives, there's not many clubs nowadays that concentrate on that, because a lot of it is how good can this look on an Instagram or on a video or on a TikTok or on a story and things like that. And
which is ridiculously sad, but then I don't know how the industry are gonna take it back. I don't know how what we've got around us now, how are we gonna bring the culture back into it. I just don't know.
Well, I think a classic example is like dubstep, right? Yeah. So how dubstep started and the like super underground parties that would happen like on like a Monday night in the most random dingy like rooms, pubs.
Like, they used to do like Forward in at Plastic People. Mm. That's a good, that was a good, strong dubstep. 140 party, and that was like fundamentally underground, you know. Same with drum and bass. There used to be a night in London called Movement, which is at a place called Bar Rumba that went for years and years. And again, it was on a Thursday night, and it was just heads, you know.
Yeah, but I think that's where a culture is built. And now look where dubstep is nowadays, with like it literally headlines 50, 60, 100,000 festivals in America, if you know what I mean, or in Amsterdam.
It's crazy.
It's mad. But I think that's the whole point, is that you still need these small kind of subcultures that get grown. And they're happening. I think what the difference is, and I can only speak for myself, but I'm not in those subcultures. I'm not trying to be in those subcultures.
Yeah.
I'm not trying to be in the underground. So I do believe that those subcultures are happening. It's just it's interesting though, because those subcultures happen still with social media.
Yeah, and still with Shazam, and still with
Do you think it's like worse, or do you think it's better?
Oh, it's worse. Yeah, it's worse, because it doesn't. You lose that for that family. You know, you use that, you know, because you really built a family of friends because you all had the same interest, you know, and there wasn't people like bubbling in and bubbling out. And I really thrived in that culture and that time because of it. Because, you know, you really, really were into it. You know what I mean? Yeah. It's like there wasn't just people that were just in it because you wanted to be a DJ or you wanted to have 100,000 followers or you wanted to wear cool clothes or something. It was just like you were in it and that was your life, you know?
Yeah.
And like, yeah. Well, like we in Bristol started a party about 5-6 years ago called Who Cares. Mm. It was me, Mensa, who, you know, NYTA, yeah. and Sam, who's just was just now, and John and James Haggett, who does Lakota.
Yeah.
And we did a cooperative night, and it was called Who Cares. And the concept behind it is that we had all of our friends from Bristol, and we had a small club. It was about 150 capacity. And what we did is we charged everyone, I believe it was £3 before 11 and £5 after. And we wouldn't release the lineup at all.
Yeah.
And what you would do is, it was just like, you just create this vibe of people wanting to come down. And the first thing that they did is that they would walk in and we would have a bit of paper with the lineup. And obviously they didn't know that. So we would have this massive queue around the block from like 9, 10 o'clock in the evening. And we would have everyone playing there. We had Stormzy playing there, Novelist, Joker, Eats Everything. And then like Plastician, Mala, and then like, you know, really like housey names as well. And we just did this thing that, because we wanted to have a crazy lineup that wouldn't necessarily be kind of got around the world.
Yeah.
And we would have like maybe a hip hop DJ, then a dubstep DJ or a house DJ. And then we'd have a drum and bass act, you know, and because people didn't know what they were going to see, they just knew that it was going to be really cool. And also they were going to like at least one of the acts on the lineup.
Yeah.
And then what happened is we just had 150, 200 people going crazy, maybe listening to music that they never heard before.
Yeah.
Like we get students, art students at, or, you know, technology students that come to Bristol and they would be like, oh my God, I've heard dubstep, or I've heard like Future Garage, or I've heard like something I've never heard before.
Mm.
And they were like, you know, I usually only go to a hip hop night, or I usually only go to a bass or 140 night.
Yeah.
And because they went and they got there early, they heard something that they never heard before. And that's something that I really, really hope to bring back in the future.
Where does that come to though, when it comes, like, let's talk business on that side of things, right? Like, I love that concept. I absolutely love that concept.
Yeah.
But if you're a full-time promoter or you're a full-time club owner, like, do you think promoters are just not doing a job at building the culture, or do you think it's not even the promoter's like role to do that?
I think without pinpointing it and pointing fingers, I think it's got a bit lazy in that obviously where I've come from, it was just dance music, and there would be one or two rooms full of that music, and that was the vibe. And if you didn't like, say if you didn't like hard techno, or you didn't like Jeff Mills or something, then you would go to the chill out room.
Go to the second room.
And you go to the second room and you do Sasha or...
Where now it's like the same DJs.
You buy what you get.
Yeah.
You know, it's like going to the store now. It's like, I want to get some Super Goose, so I go to the hardware store.
Yeah.
But it's like... But maybe back in the day, you would go to the general store and you get everything at the general store.
Yeah.
And like that really, really breeds culture.
Mm.
When if you're going to the hardware store, you're not going to get that culture, because you're only going to, you might get a Carhartt belt, but you're not going to get like, I don't know, you're not going to get a FUBU jacket.
Yeah.
I don't know if that makes sense.
No, it does. It totally makes. Where I live, like,
there's
a village called Wedmore, and it's called the Wedmore Stores. And it's literally like, you can get everything in there.
Yeah.
You just go in there and I'm like, shit, I need that. And it's like Amazon or Wedmore Stores, and go to Wedmore Stores. Yeah. You're going to pay an arm and a leg for it, but it's worth it. It's just I totally get that, and I think it's really important. But how do us as artists change that?
I think for me personally, what I learned from doing Who Cares is that I would do that again, and the concept would be to start small and keep it very organic. But from that, show the promoters and the agents and the people that are booking festivals, this is what we're doing, and can we do this, you know, at a festival? Even create a club vibe at a festival, you know, that we're doing, and start it small, you know, so people can get it and they can come to it, and say at Coachella or something like that, you could build a little club or something.
Yeah.
It's like 200-300 people, and everyone, like, it's like going to an underground club, and people come in and they see this different type of music. And if they're not into it, they're not into it. It's cool because it's only 200 people.
Yeah.
But I guarantee when you get 200 people together and they hear culturally, like, organic music, they're going to be down because they're going to want it. And yeah, you know, and hopefully if we nurture it, then it could get bigger and we could go to a party with, say, 2,000 people. And you could hear drum and bass, and then you could hear house music, and then you could hear hip hop and disco and boogie side by side. You know, it'd be great to see, say, Natasha Diggs and Jada G, and then go and see Jeff Mills, and, you know, have that all side by side because it's good music. Yeah. You know what I mean?
No, I totally agree. I think it would be really interesting. I always say this on the podcast, when I used to work at Space in Ibiza, on We Love Sundays, that was for me the last party that would do something like that, they would kind of nurture new artists in and like really make them part of the furniture. Like Paul Wolford was one of the residents there like years ago,
and
now look where he's at. Disclosure were like the warm-up kids.
I was just about to say that. Yeah, I remember Disclosure being there. That was the that was one of the first years actually I went there.
Yeah,
and it was so special.
It's dude, that place, and then you had Alfredo, like playing the sunset on the terrace.
Yeah,
and then you had like a Carl Cox playing. I know Carl used to have his own night, but like even on Carl's night when it would be Carl Cox, he'd play a disco set on the sunset terrace. Yeah. He'd then play a house set on the terrace, and then play like a banging techno set in the discotheca. Yeah. And I just think I don't know what it is why we can't do that. But I think it's.
I remember chatting to quite a lot of people about this the last sort of 2-3 years, and also like on social media as well, like asking people. And I felt like quite a lot of the younger people felt like they wanted to know what they're getting now.
Yeah.
And that it's their part of their culture now, is that if they want to go to a drum and bass night, they want to go to a drum and bass night. They don't really want to hear any other music.
Yeah.
And the same with techno. You know, if you're going to, say, Cocoon,
you
might not want to hear a Speed Garage set in you know? Even though, saying that, even though I remember going to Cocoon, I remember seeing Ricardo and Sven, and I remember them playing two or three Garage tunes, and I have never seen Amnesia go off that crazy in my life.
Well, I think this is, like, I've seen it a lot. Dennis Salter kind of was a big part of it back when he first started it. Like, this sounds random, but when he played that ABBA record.
Yeah, sure.
Give me a man after what song's that? Give me a man. It is called Give me it.
Yeah,
anyway,
I think
and now I'm seeing a lot of people doing it. And the thing is, it just brings a different, it's the art of DJing, right? And
it's the part of the party.
Yeah, exactly.
It is a party.
Yeah.
Let's not forget this. Like, we can all be heads in our music, but when you come as a DJ, you're a party. It's a party. And that's the key about it, you know?
You're there to entertain, aren't you? And
that's our job as a DJ. We're disc jockeys. Yeah. Like, let's not forget that.
Yeah, I think that's the thing, though, isn't it? There's a huge amount of ego. I spoke about this on the last podcast as well, and we spoke about it last week.
Yeah,
there's a huge, there's a huge amount of ego in this industry. Well, not just in this industry, in this life, in the world.
Yeah. I mean, and especially within the entertainment business, anyway.
Of course, but I think it's in everything. But I guess insular to our own industry, it is just massively like, oh no, you're signed to this label, I can't have anything to do with you. Oh no, you're signed to this label, like, I can't have anything to do. It's a bad look on me. I had the conversation with a mate that I'm writing music for at the moment.
Yeah,
she's doing like a really commercial record, and I'm like, do you want to be associated with that? But realistically, the real answer, the real question was me, was would you ever play this in your sets?
Yeah,
and I think it's something that we all do.
It's about having outlets as well. And I guess we talked about this briefly last week, but I guess being on the podcast now, is, for me, doing Got Some, I think it's hindered me quite a lot, my ego, in that I wanted to be accepted by everyone.
Yeah.
I wanted to be, like, cool. Mm. Like, I spent the whole time with, if you look at Got Some throughout the couple of years or whatever, I've written a bunch of commercially viable records.
Yeah.
And then I've tried to backtrack and write some cool underground deep house music. And it's like, I shouldn't really care. Mm. I should be like, if I'm into it, I should be behind it, you know?
Yeah.
And not worry about, should I do this and should I do that? And then over the last like year or so, especially since the lockdown, I started writing another alias, and obviously telling you now, but I'm not really like shouting about it. I'm just writing it, playing it within certain sets. I've got a radio show in Bristol, and I'm just like doing that. And I've got the understanding now that I'm kind of feeding my ego in a positive way, which allows me to put some time into Got Some and not worry about it and be like, you know what, let's do it. And like looking at Paul Wolford especially and Special Request, it really, really opened my eyes, man, and being like, you know what, Paul's doing his thing and he's not feeling no way. And you know what, if he wants to write a really nasty jungle tune or drum and bass rave tune, he can write it and put it in Special Request and do it, and that makes him happy, you know?
Yeah. It's really interesting, but it's also kind of worrying that you can't do that under your name.
Normally, being a little extra might be a bit much, but not when it comes to healthcare. That's why UnitedHealthcare's Health Protector Guard fixed indemnity insurance plans, underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, supplement your primary plan so you manage out-of-pocket costs. Learn more at uh1.com. A lot can happen in the next 3 years. Like a chatbot may be your new best friend. But what won't change? Needing health insurance. UnitedHealthcare Tri-Term Medical Plans are available for these changing times. Underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, they offer budget-friendly, flexible coverage for people who are in between jobs or missed open enrollment. The plans last nearly 3 years in some states, with access to a nationwide network of doctors and hospitals. So for whatever tomorrow brings, UnitedHealthcare Tri-Term Medical Plans may be for you. Learn more at uh1.com.
Again, it's kind of the way that the culture's gone now. Mm. And that maybe in the 80s and the 90s, or, you know, even in the early 2000s, you could have done that.
Yeah.
But now, because everyone feels like they want what they want, you know. It's like having fusion dinner. Do you know what I mean? It's like, do you want a fusion dinner or do you want to have sushi, you know?
Well, yeah, but even sushi's or like fusion nowadays, California roll is not a fucking Japanese thing.
Yeah, you know exactly. I mean? Like, exactly. I don't know how my food reference is going well now. I don't know.
I know people in Japan hate the fact that there's a California roll, but they have to sell it on their things now, their menus, because it's just like,
yeah, exactly,
Americanized.
But yeah, I mean, in an ideal world, if we had it open, I would like to be able to do a record label, a party, and DJ, and be able to play a spectrum of music. Mm. That is a dream that I would like to have. Maybe in 5 years we'll be having this conversation, and within my new concept or alias, I'll have that. And that's the dream, you know. I want to be able to have a party that is, you know, everyone can come to, you know, different ages, different sexes, different sexual orientations, everyone to come in and feel included and be able to listen to the music and feel free.
Yeah.
I know that sounds like such a cliche.
Well, I don't think it does, because I think that's what this culture was built on initially.
Yeah.
This culture was, it's a gay culture. It started in gay clubs in America, in New York, Chicago, and Detroit.
Yeah.
Detroit wasn't necessarily the gay clubs. It was more like just techno boys and girls. But like it's a black culture, black gay culture.
Yeah. I really just need to see that again. Not even necessarily to be a part of it, but just to be in clubs and have that. Like, you know, obviously when I first started raving, when I was going to jungle drum and bass nights and hip hop nights, like I was surrounded by different cultures.
Mm.
And it wasn't even a thing. It was like there'd be a Chinese Asian guy there, there'd be an Indian guy there, there'd be a African guy there. There'd be, a guy from Japan. And it was like, that was normal.
Yeah.
And especially within jungle, was like jungle music in them days, and even with Speed Garage and stuff, it was just like, that was normal. Like if you look at like old Todd Edwards videos of raves, it was mixed. And like, tell me in the last 5 years, like how many parties in the UK have you been to, especially like Tech House and stuff like that, where you could turn around and say that?
Yeah.
I mean, maybe more in London, but like, if you go to regional parties, it's so segregated now.
Well, even in America, I could be speaking wrong, so I'm happy to be wrong here. But I don't know if it's purposely done. I think it's just cultures. We were talking about the other day with hip hop and house. It's like kids. Well, you can kind of explain what you're saying about people wanting.
Younger kids of different ethnic backgrounds. I don't think they're drawn to dance music as much as we were in our day. And I just like, for me, being a white guy, but being brought up around loads of culture and loads of different colours, I find that really sad.
Mm.
And I just like, moving forward out of this pandemic, that's one thing I really want to see. I really want to see go to parties where everyone is included. Like, I want to go to a party where a young black or Asian girl is DJing.
Mm.
And more to the point, I'm surrounded by different cultures and everyone's enjoying the music. Because I'm just bored of going to clubs where there's just like 2,000 white dudes there. It's like, that's not the culture that I was brought into.
It's not. And I think it also like brings a different vibe to the party, because different cultures bring a different atmosphere. And that's just how it is. It's different cultures are different types of people.
Yeah, it's funny. I was doing an interview with someone a couple of weeks ago, and they were asking me about the first raves I went to. And I remember going to one of my first jungle nights was in an African Caribbean center in the middle of Bristol. It was actually called the Malcolm X Center. And they used to do raves in the basement of the Malcolm X Center. And I used to go there with my mate, Dale. And he was, his mum was from Jamaica and his dad was from England. And we used to go together. And I was usually the only white kid there. And I was a kid, like I was like sneaking through the back door.
Yeah.
Like I shouldn't have been there. Like, I was way too young. And I just remember coming through the back door, and I remember smelling the crack, seeing the drugs, being a bit scared, you know, like about knives. Everyone carried knives then. And I was like, you know, and I would come home and I was like, I'll be buzzing from it.
Yeah.
You know, because it was scary and it was uncharted waters for me at that time. And there was music that I'd never heard before, you know. And there was jungle music then. There was an amalgamation of it was like reggae, R&B and rare groove and jungle techno all mixed up together. And at that point, it was like, it was groundbreaking. And I would just go to the school then, and I'd be like, yeah, I went to this place, you know, and I was the only white guy.
Yeah.
And it was like, and then obviously it got bigger and it was you know, more multicultural. But when it was most multicultural, that was the best. Like, the feeling in the crowd, it was a bit edgy.
Yeah.
You know, it was scary. Like, yeah, a fight could happen and someone could have a knife. Or there would be, you know, gay couples kissing in the crowd and people on ecstasy, and everyone was, like, having this amazing time. And I just, yeah, just people to be included. I mean, that's the main thing, isn't it?
I think it's really important. Obviously, I think for me, like, I don't want a place to be unsafe for people to go. The whole reason for me, a club, I want people to be able to escape the unsafe reality that a lot of people have nowadays and kind of feel they go through, and they,
yeah,
not just like in life, but like mentally and everything like that, but being able to go to a club and true escapism. And I think, yeah, that's kind of also how it started in America. It was like the black and the gay industry or scene weren't allowed in normal clubs. They weren't allowed in. They'd be turned down. So they started their own cultures. And it's just like, where did that go? I don't know. I'm not gay and I'm not black, so I can't really comment on it. But it's like, why are all the gay clubs now in most places just really cheesy, shitty, poppy places?
I don't know. I guess us being white kids and in the position that we're in, I guess we just need to be open to it. You know, we just need to promote it and visualize it and bring it into what we're doing. You know, if they want to be involved in what we're doing, then we should promote that. Yeah, we should promote what they're doing in their places, you know, and build it up. And even for them, like, not even for me or for us, like I'm lucky to be a part of that, you know? And I just think that's, you know, obviously, like, what Glitterbox is doing, and even, like, the thing on TV, Pose, you know, about the drag queens and about Vogue and stuff like that. I mean, it's just like, we just need to have that in our culture. And I think, you know, what Simon and what Glitterbox are doing is cool. And just really, really want to have that more, I guess.
It's also about doing it for the right reasons, though, isn't it? It's doing it to build culture rather than to make money out of the minority.
Yeah, I mean, the main thing for me is just to have, like, not even for me to be a DJ or to be a promoter, but to me to be in the crowd and soak that up.
Yeah,
because that's richer than any money I can get.
Totally,
because that's fundamentally where I've come from. I've come from being in a room and being surrounded by that culture, and like that, and that for me as a producer or a DJ, that will give me lots more, because then I can go out and make music and feel the vibes to give back to those people. Do you know what I mean?
Yeah, totally. We are very lucky. Like, obviously I didn't grow up in Bristol, but I grew up around Bristol. Yeah. We are very lucky with how Bristol is as a culture and as how a community is, because it does very much look after itself and promote different cultures.
Yeah. 100%. Yeah, yeah. It's like even walking around the streets, like, fundamentally you have them people around you.
Yeah.
I remember I think you asked me, or someone asked me again in an interview a couple of weeks ago, how and why I wanted to become a DJ or a producer. And I remember there was one thing that happened. There's a street in Bristol called Gloucester Road. And I'll be walking up and down Gloucester Road, like, skateboarding or whatever. And I remember seeing one of the guys from Massive Attack. And I must have been about 17 or something. And I just remember seeing them. And that was at their, like, pinnacle, you know, time. And that, I had a realisation, do you know what I mean? Like, a guy from Bristol that's chatting to me on the street is an international pop star, superstar. And he's sitting there chatting to me. It's like, I could do this if I wanted to do it. Do you know what I mean? And I went back and, you know, DJing, and later became into production and putting out records. You know, obviously I'm not as big as all the other guys that I'm surrounded by, But that was like something that really, really like drew me in and allowed me and was a positive thing to go and say, you know what? I can do that. And the same for kids right now. It's like, I see loads of up and coming producers like walking along the street and I love to sit there and have a conversation with them and, you know, give them some advice or just, you know, tell them what I went through, not necessarily advice. Do you know what I mean? But, you know, like that's really important. And I don't know if people do that in other cities or countries or whatever, but in Bristol, we do that, you know? So
yeah,
if you see someone on the street, you show them some love.
The Bristol scene has very much always been like, I've never been part of it. I've never like kind of fully immersed myself into it. And I regret it to a certain extent for not like being a part of it. But I think, I think you do generally have to grow up in Bristol to be part of that.
It's one thing growing up in Bristol, but also it's like, it's that time of like, and I say this to quite a lot of up and coming DJs, actually, it's just like, if you want to do it badly, then you've got to immerse yourself in it. Mm-hmm. So like, say if you want to be a DJ, it's like, you've got to go to the parties.
Yeah.
And you've got to like hang out with all of the people at the parties with the music that you like playing. Or like, if you're into hip hop and drum and bass and house music, go and like hang out with everyone.
Yeah.
And you go to the house parties or you, you know, you hang out down the park and you listen to their music, you know, and then you become a fan of the music, not just wanting to be a part of it, you know, and that's like, that's really important.
Well, I think that's a lot of the issue, isn't it, nowadays, and that's why I think we have so much music that's just carbon copy of everything else, because people see the success in the DJ rather than the work behind being the DJ. So you get, let's say for instance, there's a massive record, Beatport number one. How many carbon copies of those Beatport number ones do you get for the next 2 years? Like,
and also how many crying nights did the producer go through to even get that number one? Do you know what I mean?
Years
of ups and downs. And even when you're making it, like, the amount of like anxiety of the ups and downs you go for it is incredible. I was thinking when I was having like some downtime and I was thinking about Kanye West. I was like, imagine what Kanye West goes through every time he like writes a massive hit and then he fails. Like, and then he's like, oh, I'm gonna, you know, like when he decided to make shoes, when he was like, yeah, I'm going to make the Yeezys. And he went to Paris and everyone laughed at him. Mm. It's like, imagine going to bed, how bad he felt like. Well, and then he got up and he was like, oh, yeah, I'm going to just, you know. I'm not bigging up Kanye because, like, we love and hate him, but can you imagine his anxiety attacks that he gets?
I think the part of being an artist is you have to fail so many times and you have to get good at failing. Well, it's life, isn't it? You have to get good at failing.
Fail more than you do well. And I think the people that don't fail enough, it means when they're, career starts going down, they fail even more worse because they go in a downward spiral. Mm. But if you've got like peaks and troughs, when you go to your peak, you're excelling a lot more because you know what you've been through in your trough.
Yeah.
But if you're like up, and I know loads of DJs that have been up, and then the COVID happened, and they've struggled so much harder because they haven't had that trough.
Yeah.
So all of a sudden they've been forced to have a trough.
Mm.
Like they're forced to like not be earning money.
Yeah.
Like, don't get me wrong, I've gone from earning lots of money to not earning lots of money to earning more money and then not earning money. But if you've just been on a straight up, and then all of a sudden you're down, that's going to blow your mind. Do you know what I mean?
It's just not what you're used to, right? And
yeah.
I think that's it. When you're not used to something, it kind of hits you harder. But
you've got to take that as a humble.
I think that's the thing, is that a lot of people people that really want to do something, they will just keep doing it until they get to the point of they're at that point. It's when you're doing it for the wrong reasons that those people kind of fail and don't come back.
But it's definitely noticeable, and also like I want to be supportive to all of the people that are going through that, because we are all going through it.
Yeah.
Like I guess for me now is like I've kind of got used to like striving. I've got not got used to it, but like, so now when I'm become successful again, it will give me more like, you know, I'll be happy for being there because I've gone through these downtimes, you know?
I think that the part of it is the part of the fun is the struggle.
Yeah.
Because when you, like, I haven't had a hit record yet, and I've had records that have been successful, but I still haven't had a hit record that like is absolutely smashing and being played everywhere.
Yeah.
And I think I'm actually kind of happy that I haven't, because I've had, I've built foundations and I've built something around me that when I do have that hit record, it will be a lot more enjoyable to kind of roll with, rather than going, oh, what's next? What's next? Because I don't know about you, but everything, when I release a record and I have really high expectations of the record and then it doesn't.
It always goes wrong, doesn't it?
Always goes wrong. Always.
Yeah. I prefer to just like hope for the best, but like for me now, I just want to keep going. I'm not like, I'm not going to go, oh, I'm going to get a hit record and then tour for 2-3 years. I just want to write music.
Yeah.
Like regardless of what it is, I want to write music with vocals on. I want to write underground music for me, myself, and a couple of my mates.
Yeah.
I just want to carry on writing music because I love writing music. It's not for it. It's like, that's what I want to do.
Yeah.
You know,
it's important, man. It's important to love what we do.
You know,
it's super important to love what we do, because there's so many people in this life that just cannot stand their day to day living. And I think what we do is we actually, by writing music for people, we actually allow people to just keep going.
Yeah, and also like enjoying it as well, like enjoying the time. I felt like when I was at my most successful time, when I was DJing a lot, some of the times I'd kind of beat my, a lot of DJs probably do this. You play like massive arenas or stages and you come off the stage and you'd be like, I don't think I've done very well, you know?
What is that about though? Do you think it's about actually being happy in your life outside of music as well as being happy in music? Because for me, like, I, one of my busiest years, 2018, I was my least happiest. I played like fucking tons of shows. I did like 120 shows that year. I was like, should be, if somebody was like, Will, you're going to be playing 120 shows this year, like 10 years ago, like I would have been like, oh my God, I can't even believe it. But I was pretty unhappy with everything else going on in my life, which then kind of
to answer your question, I think you need to be like free in your mind in that I was just coming off stage and I'd be like, oh my God, I played so badly, and like I was clanging mixes and and I should have just been like, oh my God, I just played an amazing festival in front of like 10,000 people.
Yeah,
like that's a dream regardless. Like I should be satisfied and happy with where I am. And I wasn't. And I believe now going forward in the career that I am in now, if I get there again, I need to just be happy and be like, you know what? I'm buzzing to just be here again.
No, I totally agree. I think it's key to just enjoy it. But I think also the coronavirus has made a lot of people reflect on what they did have. I don't know about you, but for me, it's like a massive reflection on how I want to move forward with my career and also what I want to leave behind as well.
Just go and be happy with what you're doing and surround yourself with people that make you happy.
Yeah, definitely.
I know that sounds pretty basic, but I think that's the key, is being around people that like that boost you up.
Yeah.
Even if you're not like on the top of the bill, you're around people that like vibe you up and be like, bro, you're smashing it. You know, you're doing this. You're doing what you want and you're going forward.
I think that's the thing, is like something that I've learned. I don't know if this is the same for you, but over the last like few years, to like, it's actually okay to say no. And you don't have to do everything you get offered. And if it doesn't make you happy, why do it? Because we're doing something that we absolutely love. Our job is what we love, but there's parts of the job that we don't love, and there's things that we don't want to do, and that's okay. And I think that's the thing that I kind of used to struggle with, is like trying
saying to yes to everything.
Yeah, it's so unhealthy.
I think that happens at the start of all of our careers, just because we want to like fit in, and we want people to like say that you're cool and you're nice. Which is kind of superficial, I guess. But
well,
but,
it's stroking that ego, isn't it?
Yeah. Yeah. And I was telling you before about that book, Power of Now, which is like, you know, I dare to say self-help book, but someone told me to read it a few years ago and I was like, I didn't really know about egos. And now, as soon as I read it, I really, really got to know about my own ego and like being driven and having a good ego and a bad ego and, you know, working with your ego.
Yeah, it's being able to recognize it when it's ego or not, right? And it's
taking yourself off and calling yourself a cunt. Excuse my language, but also it's really important to look at yourself and go, you know what, I didn't deal with that situation right.
Yeah,
but I think I don't. Someone's trying to call me. Can you still see me?
I can't see you. No.
Okay, wait.
I can hear you.
I'm back.
Yeah, you're back.
I'm back. Sorry. I couldn't turn my phone off, but yeah. I keep getting calls. I guess someone's trying to get through to me. egos, man, definitely.
It's an interesting one. Dude, we've just done an hour.
I've got people calling me.
Yeah, you're just too popular, mate. Just before we go, what have you got coming up in the future and everything like that? Have you got any records coming out? What have you got out at the moment, etc., etc.?
So what I've done is I've done a tune with a singer called Alex Mills, and it's called Shout It Back, and it's out on Defected's new imprint D for Dance, and that came out a month ago. And it's doing business. It's doing really, really well, and I'm really happy. Really happy to be back with the guys from Defected, because obviously that's where I started when I signed Bassline.
Yeah.
So that's really, really good to be back with them, and it's a really good record, and I love Alex, so check that out. And also, I've done a tune with George Kowali, and it's called In the Dark, and it came out about a week ago on Tourum. And it's with a really cool singer who's doing a different thing. So it isn't featured, but...
I thought the singer was George for some reason.
Yeah, exactly. I was like, George, man, he's got such a good voice. But yeah, that's just come out on Tourum. So check that out. And I'm in the middle of writing loads of top secret music at the moment. Nice. With loads of really, really good vocals that I can't actually talk about. I mean, obviously, I talked about Charlene before, but she's one of them. But I'm working on about 3 or 4 records at the moment that will be coming out in the next few months. So just look out for them.
Cool, man.
They're kind of big vocal, big house, proper. You know, that's what I'm influenced by. Mm. I'm influenced by Chicago, New York, Detroit sound. You know, like... Marshall Jefferson and Larry Heard, Ron Trent, and all them guys, like they're my heroes. Yeah. You know, like I love and respect their music to anything.
Amazing. No, I big vocals and big beats is my life. I love it.
Yeah,
I absolutely love it, man. It's the way forward, dude.
Yeah, well, let's try and catch up in the studio together with you and me as well.
Yeah, man, come down to me or I'll come to you.
You're
always welcome. Keep in touch. Safe travels to France, man. See you soon, man. Peace out. Big love, man. Bye. And that is a wrap. Absolutely loved it. Love Adam. He's a G. Go follow him. Go listen to his music. And go see him in a club near you. Have a great week. Keep safe. Big love.
Imagine the softest sheets you've ever felt. Now imagine them getting even softer over time. That's what you'll feel with Boll & Branch's organic cotton sheets. In a recent customer survey, 96% replied that Boll & Branch sheets get softer with every wash. Start getting your best night's sleep in these sheets that get softer and softer for years to come. Try their sheets with a 30-night guarantee. Plus, get 15% off your first order at bollandbranch.com. Code BUTTERY. Exclusions apply. See site for details.
Flexibility is great. That's why there's yoga. Flexibility for your insurance coverage is great too. That's why there's United Healthcare Insurance Plans. Underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, United Healthcare Insurance Plans offer flexible, budget-friendly coverage for medical, vision, dental, and more. One of these plans may be right for you if you're, say, between jobs, coming off your parents' plan, turning a side hustle into a full hustle, or even missed open enrollment. Want more flexibility? Find out more about United Healthcare Insurance Plans at uh1.com.
Mom deserves the best, and there's no better place to shop for Mother's Day than Whole Foods Market. They're your destination for unbeatable savings, from premium gifts to show-stopping flowers and irresistible desserts. Start by saving 33% with Prime on all body care and candles. Then get a 15-stem bunch of tulips for just $9.99 each with Prime. Round out Mom's menu with festive rosé, irresistible berry chantilly cake, and more special treats. Come celebrate Mother's Day at Whole Foods Market.